Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with David Streda, on Twitter as Carmen Speller. David founded Mellow Events and is also working with ShareSog, a very, very proactive investor. David, welcome to Conker's Corner. Thank you ever so much for joining me.
Good afternoon to you as well, Peter.
Now, David, lots of people know you on Twitter and know you from ShareSog, but some individuals don't. I just wanted to start really from the back, really, as to your journey from a young man or young child to where you are now. Just starting first with where your journey started, really.
Well, it all started in the north of England. I mean, I'm from the north, I'm not from London. Came down here when I was 19 in search of all the streets paved with gold, as they say. But no, I mean, I guess most people you interview will have had a fairly, you know, fairly regular start in life, really. I mean, my start in life was actually on the very negative side. I was born and went straight into a care home. Mm. My birth mother, who I've not technically met, I may have met, but I probably never know that. Mm. She had an affair with a solicitor, and as soon as she became pregnant, and it wasn't with her husband, she decided she had to come clean, and her husband said, "We're not having the baby in our family." They already had two children. And so I was passed away to into care. But I was really, really lucky. And my parents, who I call my parents, of my course, adopted parents, they heard about it. They couldn't have children. They were 50, 51 and 52 years old. Fantastic. And they saw that as their golden chance.
Fantastic.
You know, they heard about it and they went direct to the lady and they said, "Could we possibly be the guardians for your little boy?"
That's and fantastic.
That's how it started. So luckily they got that through because they were not legally allowed to adopt.
Yeah.
And then when I was four, they went to court and they said, "We've been looking after this little boy and we'd like to adopt him."
Adopt him. Fantastic. So what part of the country were you then for? What
that was when I was up, right up in the north of England in a place called Lyddamstown Tams.
Lyddamstown Tams, okay. Yeah, Blackpool.
And that was from a negative start, but actually it was very positive. Because
of course.
My mum and dad were the best parents you could have.
Fantastic. Schooling, education, what happened when you were in your teens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we all work with what we've got. My mum was always at home because she didn't work. My father had the tiniest business. He was business-minded, but it was really small grocery business that he delivered door-to-door in the old days before the supermarket.
Yeah.
But the supermarkets, of course, started to kill him off. Mm. And his customers became older and older people who just didn't go to the supermarket. Mm. But I lived around a business mentality. That was what my father gave me. But my mum was always at home. And she wasn't actually that well. She unfortunately had cancer when I was eight.
Sorry to hear that.
No, but she pulled through it and, you know, continued on and did everything she could. But she, every day when I got home from school, she'd give me tests. I would have, spelling, maths, name it. Mm. She loved to engage in that way.
Yeah.
And it just meant that you worked hard.
Yeah,
you had a hard-working mentality.
She wanted the very best for you, didn't she?
So aged 11, I had a test. Mm-hmm. In the local area of Lancashire, they had two scholarships to the top school.
For the whole of Lancashire?
Pretty much. Wow. I mean, there were not the, Lancashire had a few, near Manchester you would have, which was the old Lancashire, you would have one or two top schools that had scholarships as well. But on the coast where I came from, there's sort of a, big area, but, the Fylde coast is, there's only one school that offered scholarships and it was a boarding school.
Yeah.
And there were two places every year given, I think somebody wealthy had originally given these places to be paid for.
Bequeathed, yeah.
And my mother put me in for the tests.
So she'd been doing the equipment of Kuman classes with you all that time.
And building me up for it. And anyway, I took these tests and managed to get one of the two places.
Fantastic.
So, from being on free school milk at my smaller school, suddenly went into with the big boys and all the
grammar school.
Yeah, boarding school, it was a good sports school and I love sport.
Right, so okay.
It was perfect for me as far as the sport's concerned.
So 11, boarding school, what happened next for you?
Well, when as you develop as an older boy, as it were, you clearly have one or two subjects you're still keen on. I mean, you can't depend just on your spelling and your maths. I was really a very average student. I was, you know, I should have been called Justin. It was always just enough and just in time, you know. Right. And I wouldn't say I pushed my studying.
Okay.
One or two subjects I was, you know, reasonably good at, but the rest, I, you know, chemistry, physics, all those things, I hated it. You know?
Right. Okay.
So yeah, just kept battling away with the sports. Always got in the school teams for the cricket, the tennis, the rugby. Yeah. You know, you name it.
Yeah. So 18 at the university. Did you go anywhere after that?
I made a decision. I mean, it was earlier than that, really, the decision started coming through, because when I was four, I mean, I always had a job in the summer holidays. Mm-hmm. My parents genuinely were, you know, we didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
My father was still working at that point. He was 68, 69.
So that's the corner shop almost of the grocery business.
Where he was driving a wagon around. Okay. Well, not a wagon, it was like a big van with open-ended sides, and it had all the grocery goods and heavy things. He used to brew bleach and vinegar.
Wow.
He had a master brewing license for vinegar. And, you know, he would do all this at home, you know, effectively in the garage in the back garden. And, you know, he'd come out from there and he'd say, right, I've just done another 1,000 bottles or whatever. And then he'd be off out on his rounds selling them. And,
so that's where
and
you
not
your
to one party. This was, you know, he'd have
Lancashire.
150 customers a day he had to sort of pop round to see. Yeah.
So is that where you got your entrepreneurial flair and guile?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be, you know, you build with that. You know, I did bits for him when I was probably 8, 9, and 10, because in those days you had coupons that were put through your door or sometimes in newspapers or magazines.
Mm.
And people who were his customers would be able to use these coupons and say, we want that, you know, 5p off the washing up liquid or whatever.
Yeah.
So he had to collect those and get cashed for them afterwards. So I'd be his sort of secretary at home.
Right, okay.
Piling up all these coupons, tallying how much, you know.
Brilliant.
And then there were little things that would happen. I don't know, you probably won't remember. There were 5 pence pieces at the old shillings that had silver content in them, pre-1947 coins.
Right.
And his bag would come back with all the piles of coins because he collected all the money. Yeah. I'd be going through those to try and find these pre-47 ones because they were worth 6 times the amount of the... Yeah, if you had a group of them and... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long story. But, I mean, my mind was always on making money, always.
And then
the next thing I did for myself, which was in the summer holidays, I was working on different jobs.
Yeah.
Because of my spin bowling technique, I worked out that on a fairground, which is the biggest in the country, to be honest, is Blackpool Pleasure Beach,
of course.
They had 3 of these competition games where there'd be 18 horses in a row on a big backdrop, where you had a ball and a chute in front of you and you had to roll the ball up the chute. There were holes at the top, holes in the middle, holes around the side.
Yeah.
And you scored points depending on how far you got it up the chute. To get in the top hole,
of course.
3 points.
Yeah.
Your horse would move 3.
Of course.
If you only got it in the bottom one, you only got 1 point, your horse would only move 1 place.
Yeah,
I mean, it's, you know, it was fun.
Mm.
Kids play, everybody played it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there'd be queues to get on it. And I would sit down and try and have a practice, see if I could work a way of getting it not through the middle, but up the sides with spin.
Mm.
Hits the top corner into the big, well, not it wasn't any bit different
three,
size,
the,
but into
the
big,
the, most, yeah.
the big moving hole, you know, the 3. I would get it perfected so I could do it 9 out of 10 into the 3. So I would literally wait until, I'd be on a horse, I'd wait until the ride had probably started by a minute or so. All the horses were moving along. Then I'd start my move. My horse would quickly, you know, shoot through the field and end up just winning the race. Collect a voucher for, it was teddy bears and all sorts of things that you won. Mm. But I'd spend quite a lot of my time, all my lunch hours, my breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
Then eventually I thought, well, I earn more by doing that and then selling the digital watches in those days
with
a rage.
Yeah.
And other gifts and all sorts of things. I mean, this was quite a big operation.
Yeah,
big company owned 3 of these. And they said to me, look, we've worked out you're pretty good at this. You keep clear. They thought we probably can work with you on it. We don't want to ban you. But what we do see is that you actually speed up the number of races and there are lots of people waiting to play. So in actual fact, we don't mind you doing it, but you mustn't win more than once on the same horse,
yeah.
or more than twice. because people will think it's rigged. It's not,
yeah,
not
yeah,
fair.
He's working for us.
It's not
yeah,
fair.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you're going to have to keep moving. And, you know, you mustn't win a race by such a margin that it doesn't, you know, doesn't give everyone else a chance. I said, that's all right, because I enjoy doing it where I catch up. You know,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Cut a long story short, I was winning literally thousands of races over a long period of time.
Yeah,
and I would
yeah.
collect all the digital watches.
Yeah.
And then I set up effectively a selling operation to sell the benefits of my winnings, which were tax-free because I'd won them in a game, a gaming company.
So how old were you then?
14.
14 years of age, and you've already been noted by a business to say, we'll have to have a word with this young man here.
Well, I worked out that there's probably a deal to be done one way or another.
At 14.
Where we could all be happy.
Some people looking at milk rounds and paper rounds, and you're dealing with the executives of business of Funfair. Exceptional. So you'd made a decision maybe not to do additional studies then at 16, 18, or
yeah,
what
I mean,
there?
my mind had already, you know, got into business mentality.
Yeah.
I went into the sixth form, and I was happy still doing studying, but I was working a lot alongside it. I mean, to be honest, I mean, my intention in life generally was to try and just be, you know, independent, have a home of my own, like anyone else eventually.
Yeah.
And I was trying to work out the route to get there, and you know, I didn't want to depend in any way on my mother and father. In fact, if anything, I wanted to be able to look after them as they get older.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, university at that point, it seemed to me that you were going to spend 3-4 years and still not be guaranteed a job at the end of it.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
People were happy doing it, and it was an achievement in those days to have got to university.
Of course, yeah.
But I thought, is it really going to be good for me as an individual? Am I going to be any better?
Yeah.
You know, and at that point, my bank account had become quite big. I mean, the bank manager was calling me in at age 15 saying, you need to have
digital watches. Brilliant.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought, let's go for it. Let's see if I can, you know, London's probably where it all happens.
Yeah.
And there weren't many jobs in the north that attracted me.
Yeah.
And certainly not for somebody who's 18 years old finishing sixth form. So the first job, I did give it a try up in the north. My first job was in computing because that was all the rage in those days.
Yeah,
it was a computer operator job where you had training, it was with a big insurance company. You know, it was, you know, everybody wanted that job and I'd managed to get it.
Yeah,
but I was just rubbish. I mean, I just couldn't. My mind is not like a computer. Mm. It was just all way beyond me. And the guys that were in the jobs, they thought this new bright spot, we'll wind him up because he's, you know, he doesn't look like he's got a clue what
he's
doing.
He's a newbie. Let's take advantage.
So they thought they'll have a bit of fun. And I can remember once when they said, oh, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that. I did all that. I thought, followed it to the absolute, you know. And what they did was churn out computerized insurance documents, you know, all the things that you got through the post
to show
what your insurance cover was.
Yeah.
They made me press buttons that actually sent absolute reams of this paper, and I got into big trouble. You know, you're like, you just wasted like God knows how much paper and time on the computer.
They were
all laughing in the background, you know. I thought, this ain't for me. This is, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Right.
So I applied while I was still there. I mean, I was earning money. It was good money.
So
I thought, you know, I'll give it a try. But I then applied while I was at it. I applied, made sure I got another job, and I applied for a job in London, which was an information officer job, which was much more up my street.
Okay.
Part of it was sports journalism because they wanted somebody to help look after covering stories in sports.
And you loving your sports and everything
else.
Love
my sport. Yeah. And the other bit of it was to take dignitaries around central London.
Wow.
You know, I mean, at that point I didn't know central, but I mean, there was a course to look after you to make sure you do what you do. And that was absolutely up my street. So it gave me the great start in London. And but I needed, alongside it, I had quite a bit of time because you're covering sport, which might be at weekends or on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
There are days where you're not, you know, you once you finish your story, you've got 2 days free.
Yeah, yeah.
You might have to get somewhere, France or wherever, to cover a rugby match. Okay. But at the end of it, you have a lot of time on your hands.
Yeah,
so
to reflect,
I thought, what can I do? I've got a bit of money aside. What can I do? I got into property very early.
Property, okay.
Property was my, you know, my big love. It was something where I thought the money goes in, you can add value, you do things to property, and you then have a nice position with the money that you've invested. And I was finding that all my friends were coming out of university by that point. This is 2 or 3 years on.
Yeah.
they had to come to London because even though they'd gone through university, the jobs were in London again.
Work. Yeah.
So, and I was, you know, I'd already bought two flats in houses by then. Before the buy-to-let thing, by the way, because buy-to-let didn't exist then.
Yeah,
I just had to put solid money into it.
Solid deposits, yeah.
And I was renting them out to my university friends. And then the knock-on effect from that was I managed to get to know a company who had a couple of flats above some shops. And said, look, I can do the same for you that I've done for myself. Before I knew it, I was building up a property management company and it became the second largest in South London.
I mean, I just can't get into my head now, right, that you're in your mid-20s, David, and you got to the stage where you became one of the second largest property. If, to define that now, what would that mean in a scale of looking at London or South London now?
The only way I can put it is I've always been way ahead of my where I should be, immature, you know. I know I started in a strange way explaining the adoption.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to get across that I had to be independent. From such an early age that I just did these things naturally almost.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody makes bad decisions. I mean, I've set up three businesses. One obviously being the property management. First one being when I was 14. I made one that was an outrageous gamble before the property management thing, where I was putting my information mind to things.
Okay.
There was a change in the law in 1978, where the government said that anybody who drives a car could effectively take a passenger in their car and take money for it. In the past, it was illegal to do that. Your insurance would be invalid.
So this is Uber going back to 1978?
A little bit like that. It was to try and open the roads. They allowed coaches to come into London and compete with the trains. It was a big, the Transport Act 1978 from over. Anyway, I thought, hey, everybody can have a passenger in their car. In London, you know, everybody drives a car. They're all by themselves. Yeah. Nobody wants to have anybody in the car. People go up and down the country on the motorway. They're probably going the same place as somebody else to get back to Leeds, visit the family.
Yeah, of course.
Students, you know, everybody wants to get somewhere.
Yeah.
I'll put them all together. They can share a car. Let's call it car share, you know.
Yeah. Way ahead of your time again. Share. Yeah.
But what do? You've got, you know, I'm crap on computers. Technology is not my skill.
Yeah.
I'm sat there, I've got a huge filing cabinet I bought, put all the cards, index it. Fred wants to go there. It was just an unbelievable scale of a thing to do without computerization.
Yeah.
And to match all the people in different homes in the home counties.
Were you trying to do this on your own as well?
Or did I had two helpers.
Right, okay.
But I mean, it was, you know,
still not
enough. This was what can you throw at it?
And
hope you can. The idea was
great.
Pretty good.
Way ahead of its time again. Yeah.
Yeah. But boy, that was a challenge. And the thing that killed it, and this is, you know, something that happens every day to people, but something that you have to watch out for. And I see it in my investing. The big boy comes in and thinks, I don't want you coming in here taking my business. So I'll tell you where the problem was, because generally I'll find a way of doing things.
Yes.
So my head says, where are all the drivers of the cars? I can't stand at the traffic lights and give them a leaflet and say, come on, you shouldn't be in your car by yourself. I thought, car parks, central London car parks, they're all paying 10 quid a day. You know, they're all driven there by themselves. The car doesn't run away from you when you put the leaflet on it. Loads of leaflets. I went and had 50,000 leaflets printed.
Yeah.
Got my young helpers to come along with me. We went in all the car parks in central London that we could find on the on the map.
Did you go to the football stadiums as well?
We were aiming at the workers. People have come to work every day and wanted to go home every evening. And so in go the leaflets under the, you get these things still when you're out, you know, under the windscreen wiper. You got a leaflet, mate, there you go. How do you like to get to know about car sharing and how much you could earn from it? And you could take a, you know, anyway. Within probably about 3 hours, the office number that was on the leaflet, get a call. It's listed as acting for NCP.
Wow.
They don't like you. And immediately they wanted me to, wanted to get a court injunction, wanted me to stop going onto their property, wanted me to, you know, company will have to, you know, it was heavy stuff. I was thinking, OMG, what do you do?
You're taking money out of their coffers, aren't you?
Exactly. They didn't want it because every car that potentially shared a journey, there could be two people going the same place from the same
one less car in their car park.
Exactly. They thought, we'll only have half the number of cars in here next week. So, I felt like there was somebody following me everywhere. It was like, honestly, you wouldn't believe it. I was,
brilliant.
So I thought, that's going to have to end, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And then after that, you obviously were still growing your property portfolio.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was very sound.
And you grew that. And then it was taken over by quite a large entity.
Yeah, I built it up. Now, at this point, I'd started having a good few kids. So you're in a position where you have to make decisions in life.
Yeah.
How hard do you really want to work?
Yeah.
How much time do you want with your family?
Yeah, yeah.
The property management business took a hell of a lot of time because it was solid. It was a great company.
Yeah, yeah.
But I operated in a way that I needed to know about everything that was happening.
Mm.
I wanted a real personal attention to things. So,
you know,
all the landlords that I had, if we managed to let one of their properties, it could have been at 9:30 in the evening, didn't matter when it was, I would give them a call within 10 minutes, say, we've just let your property, I want you to, be happy that, you know, it's no longer on the market.
Mm.
It might just be, that I wanted them to know because just in case they had anybody else trying to do the same job.
Good courtesy,
make sure that, you've now brought the thing to an end.
Yeah.
But it also let them know I'm working hard.
My
team are working hard.
Yes.
We've done this at 9:30 at night when you're tucked up in bed, maybe.
Yeah.
So not like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was a good principle. I hardly ever lost any client. So it just grew and grew and grew.
Right.
But then I needed to sell the little thing.
Really. It's almost gotten too big.
Yeah, I found I could hardly go on holiday without needing to know what on earth's happening. Mm. Or somebody ringing me all the time.
No, that is absolutely exceptional.
Yeah.
So you've sold the business,
and
then you're looking and thinking, what next? There's more kids along the way, and you're looking for your next adventure. What was that?
I mean, really, you're then in a position where you have, because you've sold the business.
Yeah.
I had some consultancy I had to give them just to make sure that they didn't end up with a problem. And it was the manager of Status Quo, which is the old rock band.
Right.
He wanted to buy it for his son.
Right.
Because he felt his son needed something that was...
To keep him occupied.
Yeah. And this guy, to be fair, he'd managed a rock band. He was a fairly shrewd chappy. So he knew that it was a business that could be run, probably a little bit as well with his help and a couple of other family members. So he said, look, if you could just give us a couple of years to get it, so I was tied in. Not working full time, but I was having to spend a day a week at least to make sure they didn't go off the boil. And it also meant the landlords were pretty comfortable that I was still around.
Yeah, you're not going to send them to sharks.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so alongside that, I thought, what can I spread the money into that, gives me a return rather than obviously working all day? And equally, I didn't want to spend the time on the golf course and be doing nothing because the kids need somebody who's a little bit of a role model. They don't want, you don't want dad all the time on the golf course.
Now, I wanted to touch on founding of Mellow, the story behind that, how it started.
Yeah.
There's a particular venue that you used to frequent quite religiously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Mellow bit, to be honest, started really because it's about the year 2000 when the internet became really big, I think alongside the technology boom and everything else. So investors had started using technology to improve, how they communicated.
Yep.
So it was the Motley Fool originally that most of us used as a way to contact each other and just put out the posters, information, tell each other we existed and had an idea about a company being good done this, what do you think of this strategy, but it was all online, and that's just not me. Back again to I prefer the physical people and felt a bit awkward doing everything just through a computer and to be honest, half the time I can only literally type enough, I don't know everything else about the computer, so I wanted to engage more. And I thought, why do we not meet? We go to AGMs and I see the same people quite often at AGMs. But there's nothing after that. We just go home and back to the computer again. So I thought, I wonder if we could give it a go with a monthly meetup, and that was for investors. And hey, why don't we try and get a company and then instead of just seeing them once a year, we can get companies to come on a regular basis. And that's what I did. And I called it Mellow.
Yeah.
Only, this was in 2005, I think, 2006. I called it Mellow only because the first place that we held it was a local restaurant to me that was called Mellow.
And I thought, well, I'll give it the name of the restaurant, then everybody can remember where they go.
Excellent.
You know? And that's what, you know, that's effectively how it started.
Right.
The big problem was, though, in the downturn, that's 2008.
Of course.
Lots of businesses were going bust, having problems. Mm. Mellow, the restaurant, went bust. We turned up literally one Monday evening. It's always the third Monday of the month. We turned up one Monday. There's a notice on the door. You know, the landlords are reoccupying the property, and, you know, it's
so
all closed
you'd
up.
Already booked. Everyone
yeah,
needed to meet there.
Company there. Company.
No one
company had
phoned
were with
you
us
up to say, by the way, David.
No, I think they'd just given up on it, and just, you know, they probably didn't look through their book to see who's booked for the next 3 weeks.
Mm, mm.
And I'd not been into town and seen the restaurant with a big notice on it.
Right.
And it was a shock as we all turned up on the Monday. And yeah.
So that evening, what did you do?
We went to the local Chinese restaurant. Bit of a crazy thing, really. But, and they were swamped with all these, you know, suddenly 35 people coming in for a Chinese meal on a Monday night. But they didn't mind. But I mean, but it was
Brilliant.
A bit bizarre because we didn't have the privacy that we had with the old restaurant. Mm. So anyway, the new owners, because it did get bought, converted the name to Sea Salt, but we kept the Mellow.
Right, okay.
And
quite
so now it's at Sea Salt. It's exactly the same place.
Yeah. Excellent. So you started off as a group of 30, meeting every couple of weeks.
It was around 30. I mean, it was a flexible group. It was whoever was interested in coming for a particular company, really.
You've gone on and done all these different companies, and I believe the one you did in Derby, was it 700 or so?
Yeah, now
it's come a long, long way.
That's a big development from the original origins of having one monthly meeting.
Mm, mm. So conference, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, somebody literally said to me, this is sad that we only meet once a month. And, you know, there's lots of companies we've seen even in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if we could get them all to come back and the money where we've invested, we get to chat to them again.
Yeah.
Why don't we have an event where we just get them all together?
Brilliant.
And I thought, And they said, sadly, you're going to be the one that's going to have to
organise
it
all.
Yeah, you know, and they always say, you know, if you want somebody to do things, go to somebody who's done it before. Or, you know.
Mm.
Busy people tend to be the ones who get things done, and sadly I had to do it. So I had to take that year. I had to take about 2 months out, along with my mixed doubles tennis partner, who was really very, very good at administrative things.
Yeah, yeah.
She said, "I'll do it with you. You know, we'll give it a go." And we did, and pulled it off. I think it was in Derby, middle of the country.
Yeah.
I mean, I did it on purpose in the centre. For three reasons, I suppose, because centre of the country, nobody could complain. Oh, everything's always in London. We can't get there. Well, definitely not Beckenham. You know, if you live in Yorkshire, you're not going to go to Beckenham.
Of course.
So, you know, I said, OK, I'll pick somewhere centre of the country. I then found out one of the companies I was invested in had this conference centre. I thought, I'll have a word with them, see if they're happy to take it on. It's the first one.
Yeah.
Don't hit me with a big bill. You know, I'm going to try and get you guys in the spotlight too.
Mm-hmm.
And we all worked together on it. They were brilliant up in Derby. You know, it was a quirky place, but it
worked.
Everybody loved it.
Yeah,
three solid days. Mm. You know,
well, people are still raving about it now.
Yeah. And we had lots of companies. Mm. You know, that, I mean, actually, I do have the sheet here.
Go for it.
And you know, the companies and the fund managers was a list to die for.
Mm.
You know, I used all my contacts. I said to them all, look, help me out, guys. You know, we've got hundreds of investors want this event.
Yeah.
Lots of companies. Mm. We'd love to have a few speakers each day to really give it a good feel.
Boost. Yeah.
And we had Gervais Williams, Charles Hargreaves, Lord John Lee, Judith McKenzie, Katie Potts, Leon Borosh, who's a well-known private investor, ISA Millionaire that you mentioned earlier, Paul Jordan of Amati, Paul Scott, the well-known blogger on the Morning Blog, Richard Rose, who was the chairman of a number of companies, Peter Pereira Graves, the head of the Wellcome Trust investment, Andy Brough of Schroders, and more and more. I mean, we
Fantastic.
Had unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it was, everybody said, that,
success.
You know, the value of that event was, you know, being able to sit down in one place, sat all day in the theatre and just listen to every single talk. It was great.
Absolutely brilliant. Now, is there a plan to do a 2017 as it would be now?
Yeah, well, we did a 2015 one because we went to Peterborough then, and that was a slightly different event. That was a two-day one, and we covered lots of topics that affected investors.
Yeah.
My next plan, at some point, I would like to try and do it early in 2017, but it'd have to be probably May time.
Okay.
I'd love to have a 3 days is a lot. You know, it takes a lot out of you. Maybe a one-day event or at worst two.
Okay.
And that would be in London somewhere, central London.
Okie dokie.
But the big problem, because, you know, this is an investor doing it for investors.
Yes,
I'm doing it because
yeah,
I want, I feel for what people will want, and I hope to get it right each time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it costs a lot of money. Mm. You know, you are taking on a lot of risk if you do it in central London, because every venue wants 20, 30 grand just to put your name down to, you know, host it. And, you know, you know, everybody else wants more money as well, because, you know, it's just costly doing it in central London. So we'll see.
Looking at it. Right, I wanted to touch on the stocks that you've got currently, right? And I know when you started, it's very, very different to which stocks you've got now and your strategies and your thought processes.
It doesn't change too much. I do have a long-term portfolio.
Okay, that's good, that's good. Okay, so what initially attracted you to the investment arena? Because you obviously started in property, sports journalism and all the rest of it. So what was it that then said, well, it, you need to diversify away from that?
Yeah, it started in a loose way when I was at school, really, because I did economics in the sixth form.
Right,
and
okay.
I must admit, I had a great economics teacher. He was really keen on, you know, children getting to understand commerce and business very early. And he wanted us to take part in a Daily Telegraph shares competition, which was a team competition.
Yeah.
And our team came third, unbelievably. And, you know, it got me looking at the share prices and what companies did and how they did it.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we had a good little team, obviously, and it gave me the initial thought, this is quite interesting, this share stuff. There might be a way of making some money there. So I think probably even when I was first investing in property, I was still doing a little bit. I'm keen on having little boxes of investments rather than everything into one. And, you know, I definitely have, you know, I can remember doing Dixon's. That was, you know, I mean, now it's called Curry's,
Dixon,
I think.
But, no,
I mean,
Dixon's car phone is called now, isn't it?
Oh, it is? Oh, gosh. Yeah. Lose track. I don't do big companies anymore. But I mean, the original Dixon's was really a camera shop.
Yes, it was just electric.
If you can remember it when we were kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always remember going there when I got my first tape recorder and my first camera, you know.
Yeah.
So they always seemed like a good operation, and I invested in them, and I did really well on those. And,
yeah.
And I think in those days, I would just invest in things that I'd got to know, you know.
Right, okay.
Whichever company I got to know and thought they were good, I'd look at their shares. Okay. But I never did the really small companies that I do now, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't able to really tune in that earlier.
Okay, so you've touched on Dixon's. Do you remember the very first stock that you purchased?
It probably was Dixon's, really.
You think it was? Yeah. Okie dokie.
I also, don't ask me why, but I also remember a retirement homes company that I did. And I think that was because of the property angle. I think I read somewhere.
You understood the background.
And I was down here in London. They were doing them in the home counties, doing these. They were developing flats for those who got to 60 and wanted to ease down and have simple lifestyle, but with really high quality sort of things around them.
So that was before McCarthy Stone and
it was. I think they were called Beechcroft.
Right.
Rings a bell. About the 1980s.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right then. As an investor, David, I know you like your small caps, and you like to research, and family companies you like as well. How would you describe yourself, whether it be a high risk, low risk, cautious investor?
I'm definitely not high risk.
Yeah.
Medium risk, I guess, because small caps, by the nature of them, are of some risk.
Yes,
but,
of course.
I mean, my strategy has changed over the years. You know, I mean, when you're younger, you tend to look at different things because you feel you can take that little bit more risk.
Yeah.
As you get older, you realise where that risk can take you and what happens if you lose all your money
in a
company.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've tweaked bits. Every so often I'll, you know, probably, for want of a better word, have a crazy moment and go into something that's in a far off place that I'm never going to be able to check out properly.
Yes, yeah.
You know, there was one in China that I got into that I thought this looks, you know, because China had become the buzzword about 7 or 8 years ago now. But then when you start digging around, you realise, oh my gosh, this isn't looking good. So we swim in different ways. But my course generally is in fairly safe UK companies that are family mentality, really.
Because
I find that the family mentality is good. If you find a company that, you know, has been probably around for tens if not hundreds of years, And there's family names on the shareholder register.
Yeah.
Many of them not now working in the company, so they're just like you and I,
shareholders. Yeah.
The people who are running the company are probably unlikely to make any big gamble with the family silver, as it were, because they wouldn't want to be responsible for ending the family
dynasty
bloodline.
Absolutely.
It's it's the way I like to sort of get to know them, and I act like a family member because I get to know the directors.
Yes,
you know, I get to know sometimes the family members by going to AGMs because some of them go to AGMs, and I just generally act like I want to be treated as much as anyone in the family.
No, that's good. But I was going to touch on sector preference. Do you have a sector preference at all?
Not really. I mean, I made a few notes. Mm. I mean, I do like technology, even though I'm not a technology geek or any kind.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I find that as the kids that I've got have developed, they're the ones who give me the they tell me where things are going, and I just see technology has been a really developing theme obviously over the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
So you're in a position where you can, if you pick the right ones, do really well.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. You're going to go places with it if somebody gets the technology right.
Yeah.
And, I like retail because I can understand retail. And recently, retail is online, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Old industry, I like old industry if it's attached to property as well. Because, you can have some companies that, they might not be doing the same trade in the same way they did it years ago. Mm-hmm. But as long as they're well run and the goods are still in demand, they're probably made now in a far-flung place.
Yes.
But the property that they've got, for either storing it or no longer needed, that could be worth a lot of money. Yeah. Could end up being developed. So you've got a bit of a safety net with the assets that they've got.
Yes.
But you've also got a chance that there's big beneficiaries of scale and cutting costs from having it brought in from overseas.
Now, I wanted to touch on the fact that you said about the fact you like to involve yourself in family firms and they've got a lot of skin in the game, so they're looking after the shareholders, etc.
Yeah.
However, then you moved into ShareSog as an active investor, really, for the complete opposite reasons, in the sense of there's lots of companies out there, some companies out there that are up to no good.
There are.
And you're fighting the challenges for the private investor.
Yeah, it's inevitable that if you've got a market, everybody's not going to be identical in the market and the way they do things. So you've got, and I think others have picked upon it, you've got lifestyle mentality of some directors. This has become a really nice way to operate.
Yes.
Doesn't matter about the shareholders, just keep, either keep raising money because we've got a lovely story or, don't need to raise money, but why do we need to be listed? Well, mainly because we can justify a big salary. And, certain things will happen that probably the average man on the street and definitely the smaller shareholders won't agree with. They won't like it.
Yeah.
But what do? They're just a small part of a bigger company.
Mm.
And sadly, the majority of, investors in the city, the fund managers, the institutions, the pension funds, they don't really either see it that way or don't want to kick up a fuss.
Yeah.
Or they've got conflicts of interest for various reasons. Mm. So they don't do anything. So we're the ones who are keen to do something.
Yes.
But we need the support or we need to be bigger.
Yes, of
course. To say, hey,
yeah,
you don't do that.
Yeah, let's work together. Yeah.
So that's where ShareSock came in. I mean, I was one of the founders of ShareSock, really on that basis, because we needed a bigger voice. We needed somebody to speak up for us all.
I wanted to touch on some of the victories that ShareSock have had since they started. Well, 10 plus years.
I mean, it depends on how you define a victory, a success, really.
Yeah.
But we've had lots of campaigns, and we've had many that have actually made the directors completely change the way things were done.
Yeah.
So that's definitely
a
success.
Yeah.
But we've had some where it still happened. The bad thing still eventually would push through.
Yeah.
But it was in so many newspapers and so many things had to then be slowed down. Even one of them, Lee's Foods up in Scotland, it went back to the courts because, they weren't comfortable that all these shareholders were kicking up. So they didn't think maybe there was something that it couldn't be done. So the vote had to be really carefully checked. And, I think just that, just those things in the papers, directors in the future then think,
exactly.
It might not be so easy to get that through.
Exactly.
So we're doing we're doing a good job.
Doing a fantastic job. You almost covered this question already, but the essential criteria is, David, when you are selecting a stock, that pushes David Strader, after all his research, to go, I'm having that. I'm buying some of that stock.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can probably take it further back than that. It's how do I ever even come across an opportunity? But usually, I mean, when the kids are all in bed, usually between about 11 o'clock and 2 in the morning, because I'm one of those, I'm lucky, I only need about five and a half hours sleep.
You're like my colleague Stephen then.
Yeah, so I just have those hours and I'm quiet and no phone call. I'll just research things online and look at trends of, you know, different, whatever it is, products. I'll look at bulletin boards, see if somebody's flagged something up.
Yeah.
I'll check a company that looks lowly rated on PE ratios or cash flow, all sorts of things, that genuinely it shouldn't be that price.
Right.
And then I'll think, right, I'll make a few notes. There's four companies to look at. I'll ask a few investors the next day, have you looked at this one? You know, generally build my thinking mentality of whether it looks a decent company. Mm-hmm. Then I'll ring up the directors and I'll start asking a few questions that I would normally ask of any company. But I'll ask them in a way to say, is there a reason why you feel that you're undervalued? And I'll actually say, you know, this looks undervalued. They might say, if they get a bit awkward, then I think maybe they know something I don't.
Yes.
But usually, you know, they'll say, well, we'd love the share price to be high, but we're not so sure why, and whatever the reason, I'll engage with them and say, well, actually, you know, the share price tends to be moved by small investors, because I'm afraid when you're under 150 million market cap, if you don't get, you know, a few investors to like you, your fund managers you haven't been able to engage with, your share price is probably only going to go one way. And sadly, there's always going to be a few of those companies. But I like them. So I'll say, do you want to come and present to a group of investors? Do you want to give yourself a chance to get known?
Yeah.
And some of them take it. If they don't take it, I get a bit wary. Why are they not interested? Are they really just happy to be in a quiet corner and nobody looking at them?
Yeah. Because what I found interesting looking in some of the research I've done for this interview is that I noted that several or quite a few of the companies that you've invested in previously are from the north. So I'm thinking, is that A, because that's where David was brought up, or is because, you know, they've been undervalued because they are not from London or not around the central of England.
Yeah.
And David's done his research and thought, why are they not taking a notice of that northern company? And you brought them to the London, they've done some shows, and then gradually over time, the appreciation has led to the price appreciating.
Well, I'd say there are a few common denominators, but you're spot on that quite a lot are from the north, or even, you know, sometimes it could be the, you know, west or Wales or where, but Yorkshire, Scotland, north of England generally, you do find companies that, and this is also probably down to the background of the directors, you know,
humble upbringings.
Exactly, and a Yorkshire and a Scottish mentality, it tends to be, they won't like me for this, but, you know, they tend to keep the costs down. They don't want to spend too much money. They don't want to pay for PR. They don't want to do this. They don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, they know how to run a good, efficient, well-run business.
Yes.
And that's perfect for me because I'll effectively do their PR cheap for them. I can get them into the contacts that they'll need without them having to pay out for it.
Excellent.
So, if you get to, you know, knit those good backgrounds together. Yeah. I mean, probably my first real big win as far as, because my wife always remembers when this particular company got taken over, because I had the real shares and I didn't even have them through a broker, but I got certificated shares and had to receive a check in the post for this for this takeover deal. It was just a big check, and I always remember that I said, what are you going to do now? We haven't got that, you know, you're going to have to reinvest that. And it was Ben Bailey, which was this Yorkshire building company.
Really, I remember the name.
A really well-run York. I mean, they sold at the absolute peak of the market.
They were a penny stock, though, weren't they, at one stage? It was a penny stock.
It was.
Many, many, many years ago.
So, and they sold out at £7.05.
Staggering.
And the directors there, Yorkshire family, Ben Bailey was a grandfather of the people running it. And, you know, whenever I talked to them, and I used to talk to the FD a lot, and actually he wasn't a Bailey, he was somebody who'd been hired in, but he was a real good, solid Yorkshire, and I got to know him really well. And they used to joke with me, because I used to do stats on everything. You know, I would ring, I mean, this is, it's all well known how I did it, but I would ring up the sites that they had where they would have a young lady or a man looking after the sale of the houses. And I would ring up with a slightly different accent at different times, and I would check on which houses or flats or whatever were still available. And I would have a complete outline map of each site, and I knew how many they were selling then and at what prices, because I would ask the prices.
Wow.
Or the material that they sent in the post. You know, you could pretty much sketch out what was happening. So I, you know, it's good with property because they only do so many sales in a period.
Yeah.
I used to get the results pretty much, and it's all on the Motley Fool. I'd get the sales and the figures pretty much to about 3% within where they were. I knew the margins. I knew what they bought the land for.
Fantastic.
Quite often. And it, you know, I just grew with that company. And I invested and invested. Mm. Even the dividends, I would take
reinvest.
As shares.
Yeah.
And that was just one great investment. Mm. You know, and the only person that tried getting in the way of it, and this is interesting, was the father, Bailey.
Right.
His son worked in the business.
Yeah.
And he'd been given the job as sales director.
Right.
He picked up, not the FD. The FD was comfortable with what I was doing. The son, he tried to challenge it. When I met him at an AGM, he said, I understand you ring our sites, you know, and one of the girls has told me, you know. I said, yeah. He said, I don't like you doing that. You're wasting their time. I said, I'm afraid I've got a very big shareholding in your company, and it's also my company.
Yes.
And if I feel I need to be comfortable in the way that the company's running, and I need to talk to the people who are working within it,
yes,
I'm afraid I'm going to be doing it. And if you know, if you really feel you need to stop me doing that, I can probably help you. I can give you a report on who I think are the absolute best salespeople. I can, you know, and at the end of it, I said, I'm involved in property. I know on any site how much time is spent really with each customer.
Yeah.
You know, they probably got so many hours in a day where they're doing very little.
Little.
I'm sure I'm not going to waste all their time.
Mm.
And he just went quiet and he thought, what does he say to that? And
brilliant.
I'd say we just had a quiet respect for each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened with the windfall from the Bailey shares then?
Well, I mean, every time I have a windfall, and I have a windfall probably every month. I mean,
you've stacked them up over and compounded them, haven't you?
To avoid real risk, I'm not a concentrated portfolio person. I don't have just, say, 10 or 15 companies. I've currently got about 138. So
I think that's the largest I know of anybody I've interviewed thus far.
Yeah, I'm not embarrassed about it. I mean, my core sort of, I don't know, I used to say 15, but it's probably about 20-something stocks. They are the bulk of it. I mean, probably 55% will be the top 25.
Right, okay.
But I mean, the fact is the tail are either things that have been sadly left behind because they're just such small holdings and I don't want to add to them, but equally I don't want to sell them. Or there'll be ones that I'm getting to know because I like to get to know companies. Mm. So every time I take a return from something, I'll probably put it into 5 companies because their size, because I position size everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't want to go all into a company with a full maximum holding straight away.
Of course.
I'm wanting to get to know them. I want them to present to us.
Mm-hmm.
I want other investors to feel they're comfortable with them.
Yeah.
Then I'll build up. And, so, you know, I just find I feel like I'm growing plants, really. You know, keep watering them, make sure they're all right.
So you scale into stocks. Yeah. Do you also scale out of stocks?
I do.
Okay.
And that's, again, position sizing.
Yeah.
I feel uncomfortable, even though the company might be doing brilliantly. Mm-hmm. I will move it because I have a position in real shares and I have a position in spread bet.
Oh,
I do that because it's tax efficient. You know, I'm not all into spread betting, so I don't want people to, in any way in the interview, think, oh, that's a good idea, I'll go heavily into spread. It's not about that. Mm. I'm position sizing, and I would only have half of my overall position in a spread bet.
Right.
Because leverage, which spread bet, you've got to be very careful with. I wouldn't want anybody to overdo things in spread betting.
Okay.
But it does mean that if you have a gain in spread betting, it's tax-free. And that's become my ISA, to be honest with you. I've never gone big into ISAs because, you know, it would just need so much of my portfolio.
Now, you appeared in the Free Capital book written by Guy Thomas. I don't want to say which character you are, but do you want to just talk briefly about the approach when Guy wanted to interview you and why you agreed to do the book?
Yeah, I think what Guy did, as far as I know, and you know, I mean, everybody else shall remain anonymous unless their names are in there. I think Guy just sort of targeted people who he felt were probably having a strategy that would be interesting to put into a book.
Brilliant book, yeah.
And I would certainly recommend the book to anyone, really. He came and interviewed me, and it was nice. The kids were there, you know, I've got a lot of kids. They sat there, listened to it all, because it was nice for them, really. And I said to Guy, you know, if there's anything I can help you with, it's just like today. I would just explain how I do things. And, you know, and he put it all into a chapter in the book. And it's, you know, I think we all have to assess things on a regular basis on how we do it. You know, and it just helped, you know. Yeah. That was just after the downturn as well, so it's quite a key time to reflect. But I mean, my long term planning has, you know, not really changed that much. You know, I mean, we all have to go through cycles.
Exactly.
But, you know, I think if anything, you know, I bought some stocks at what was then the end of the downturn, 2009. Mm-hmm. You know, and very rapidly, you know, I was back where I was in pre downturn, because some companies came out of it incredibly rapidly, just as we've seen with Brexit. You know,
we had
those sort of things.
I was going to touch on Brexit. I was going to ask you how you fared during that and what your thoughts were prior to that.
It really was horrible. I mean, you wake up to a realisation that, you know, uncertainty is the word. You know, what are we going to do? Where are we going to be? Which company is going to be affected? You know, the FTSE didn't know where to go. You know, it was just all a mess, really. Yeah. I'm not political. I'm not a political animal in any way. So, you know, I don't mind if the will of the people is to do something, but I just think it should have been done in a much more
planned way
so that we knew exactly, you know, we should have been pretty much saying, right, this is all the planning we needed for the next exit. If you're going to vote that way, please be aware this is everything
what we've got to do.
I think most people just thought it was a vote just to say we want change.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. We don't want it how it is.
So whilst we're touching on politics, which you don't like, I do appreciate that you're talking about it. Mr. Trump, President Trump, elect.
Well, it's almost the same as Brexit again. It's like America's Brexit, because I think people don't know what on earth's going to happen. I mean, there are one or two companies that I've invested in purely because he's playing the infrastructure thing.
Similarly,
so that's
been
quite good. But I don't know. I don't really don't know how America's going to go. I mean, you know, I don't know. I was out yesterday in London, and somebody who's based in America, they more or less said they're not going back. So, I don't know. You know, it's divisive. All these things. I mean, even Brexit has been divisive in this country. You know, you get people who, you know, automatically think they can tell anybody they've got to go home.
That's just rude. Yeah. Given the many lessons that you've learnt, David, since you started investing, excluding the ones that you've shared already, what would you like to share with our audience that you've learnt? You'd like to share with us?
Did I do some notes? Let's have a look. Well, I mean, I think from my own perspective, is understand your investment. Mm. You know, I mean, too many people, I guess, hear of something, read about it in a paper. They, you know, they think a certain sector's sexy. Mm. They might think China is the place. You know, whatever it is they've heard.
Yeah.
Then they'll go and invest in it without really knowing what the company does or what its management are like.
Yeah.
Number one for me is always, well, in property, I used to say location, location, location. And you've heard that bandied around everywhere.
Did she get it from you?
I don't know where she got it, but it's right. I mean,
Kirstie.
I always, you know, I always used to, you know, bleat about that. I didn't say it in that exactly those two, but, you know, I used to say it's better buying the, you know, cheapest house in a very good road.
The worst street,
But I mean, you know, when you're buying a company, you know, and you are, you know, people shouldn't think of it as just a temporary thing. And that they're just, you know, buying shares and hopefully it'll be X the next day. Really got to say, I'm an owner now and I've got responsibilities and I need to understand what the management are saying or doing and need to know what the strategy is going forward. How are they going to be if X happens or Y happens? And I do think a lot of people don't really get to know it. I don't think they, you know, they'll, I see announcements on the BBC website, for example, that will say something's, you know, going to stop happening in, I don't know, could be an insurance thing's going to change, regulation. And they'll instantly sell a company because they think, you know, oh, I think they mentioned that they were doing claims for it, you know. And they'll just sell it, and you only need six people doing that.
Yeah.
And the share price goes, and then some more sell because they think, oh, it's, you know. And before you know it, the share price is off 15%. I'm an owner of it, and I'm thinking, but they told us at the AGM that that's not going to... And I'm thinking, I should be buying here, not selling.
Well, that happened on a couple of occasions with George Osborne when he was going to, like you say, the whiplash claims and all the other stuff regarding certain companies. And lots of, even the blue chip insurers got absolutely smashed.
It's beyond me. It's because people just don't understand what they're investing in.
Very reactive.
Yeah. And, you know, and sadly also you get the momentum traders, the, you know, the...
shorters.
Shorting, the traders who trade a certain...
Price range.
Yeah. Once it goes, but they got to. So all these things then just increase, you know, and heaven forbid, but I don't know how they work, but all these algorithms and God knows what.
Yeah.
You know, before you know it, a share price can be absolutely crippled. You know, I'm one of the few who will probably be straight on the phone to a director and asking the questions just in case.
Yeah.
He'll then say, no, of course, we told you at the. Yeah,
right.
And I'll be buying. So.
Yeah.
And then. Lo and behold, 2 or 3 days later, it'll be doing its slow recovery. So, hey, it's up to people how they operate. Yeah, but if you do it naively, you're going to get hit.
That's the news. Now, David, would you consider yourself to be a value investor, a contrarian investor? How would you describe David Stretta as an investor?
Investor.
good answer. Why do you need to be anything? Just be yourself.
I mean, you know, you just mentioned... 2 or 3 areas. Yeah, I'm all of those.
All of those.
I'll do anything.
Where there's value, there's David Stretta, basically.
I mean, I don't want to be put in any sort of real,
yeah.
You know, hopefully at the end it'll say good investor.
Indeed.
But no, I mean, I don't restrict myself. I mean, I mix with lots of people. I'm a people person through and through.
Yeah.
I mix in lots of groups. I know, you know, it will do well if there's anybody who's an investor who knows more people around the markets than I do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I meet lots of companies. I get to know just about everyone that operates within the markets.
Yeah.
My view is that, you know, there is enough for everyone to do their own way of doing things. It's what you're comfortable with. If you enjoy doing something, don't change. You know, don't try and be somebody else because you think it's suitable. Making money for them, because it might not be. And, you know, it might not for you at all. Because if you lose on your first go at it, you'll probably be hacked off and give up. So I think people have just got to grow into things and just do what they're comfortable with, you know, but engage, you know, don't hide away and don't do things isolated. So I think that's the worst thing. You know, I met a lot of people who, when they came to Mellow for the first time, they said, oh, this is a breath of fresh air. You know, all the people that I'm sitting having dinner with and we're asking questions, they're all like me. Yeah. You know, they all want to just, you know, get to know what a company does.
And learn more.
You know, he says, I go home every night and nobody wants to talk about investing. I go to work in the day, nobody wants to talk about investing.
Exactly.
So, you know.
Like-minded people in like-minded places.
Exactly, and they just attract each other and then they're happy and comfortable. Yeah. That's why Mellow exists, really.
It's brilliant that you do Mellow, and it's fantastic that it's grown into the size that it's grown to.
Yeah, you know,
it's exceptional.
Just be good with everyone.
No, I agree with that. Now, if you were starting out today, David, right, so this is you at 14, 15, reinvesting your digital watches parlay. What would you do that was different?
Ah, boy. Well, I mean, obviously, I didn't go immediately into investing in the way I am. I've had a sort of a.
But you've got that. I'm just saying about you've got that.
The one thing I would definitely say, and I mean, you know, I think we all look back with hindsight on anything, but I wouldn't change anything.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I'm very happy on how my life's gone. And I think if you always think, oh, I should have done that, or I could have done it a better way.
Yeah.
I think we need to, you know, I needed the bad news business investment so that I knew
how things don't
these
work.
Things don't always fall beautifully. Mm. You know, we all need failures. We need to lose it. You know, I lost in the football team when I was 11. We were getting beaten 6-0, 5-0, you know, whatever. You need that to then, when you win eventually in a 3-2, you enjoy it.
You know.
I think we all need the odd failure. And I have that with investing.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't change, you know, I just wouldn't change anything. But I mean, if it was to give my, you know, my kids, when I'm giving them advice about all the different things they're doing, I always say, just do things that you're comfortable with. Yeah. Don't stretch. Don't you know? Don't, you know, put all your eggs into one basket for sure. Don't you know? Don't feel that you've got to you know, that's you've got to achieve that or everything's mm-hmm. gone wrong. Just do it in your stride. And then once mm-hmm. you're very comfortable with what you're doing, do more of it. And, you okay. know, well, and grow things in a steady way.
Yeah.
No need to go crazy.
Excellent, excellent advice. I wanted to ask you about the next ShareSog event. I know you promote quite a few mm-hmm. events quite heavily. What are the next ones and where are they?
Well, we have so many ShareSog events now. I mean, we have a big event in London every month.
Yeah.
The next one's on the 23rd with four companies.
Right.
We have suppers, which we're trying to dot around the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, anywhere mm-hmm. where somebody would be keen to have a supper, we're happy to, right. you know. I know you're from Leicester, I think, aren't you?
Yes,
so,
yeah.
You know, if you wanted mm. one in Leicester, I'm sure okay. we'd have one there. But we got, mm. in the next 3 weeks, we've got one in Manchester.
Okay.
We got one in Leeds, got one in Richmond.
Yeah, okay.
Which is on the edge of London. Mm-hmm. The best place to go is the ShareSock events page. And okay. that shows you a long list of all right. the things going on.
All right, so
I mean, ShareSocks are really, you know, I think anybody who's investing and feels, you know, in a sense that they are isolated.
Yeah.
Become a member of ShareSoc mm-hmm. because then you're part of a much bigger
group.
Yeah. You can meet with other mm-hmm. ShareSoc members. You can get a feel for what you're doing.
I was going to ask regarding books, because as you know, I like my books, but is there any books in particular that you like or authors that you would say, this is a really good book to read?
I like really Friday. Short books.
Okay.
So which I know it sounds awful.
The little book of...
Yeah. yeah no, I lesson. Mean, I'm really quite organised, so I do a lot of writing, but I can't say that other than websites, I do a lot of reading.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, I would recommend Free Capital. I think it is a really good book to read. Mm. But I can't say that I read other people's musings or writings and, mm. and think, oh, I'll adapt mm. that. Or I'll pick off little bits. And obviously, mm. people send me clips of things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not a, you know, I'm not a really big reader. I don't, mm. you know, some people read when they're trying to go to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Or on the beach.
You know, yeah. Or on the beach. Mm-hmm. I hate beaches. So the holidays that we go on with the kids are always where they're all involved in things because we, you know, we're not beach people.
Yeah,
so,
not lazy.
So we go on a cruise where there's activities. Yeah. You know, we all play sports. So we mm. love challenges where we're in table yeah. tennis competitions.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So you know, we're not on the beach, so we don't mm. read too much. Yeah. You know, we're not. Some of my daughters are big readers, but not mm. the boys mm. much. And you know, I guess at night when I go to bed, I'm asleep within 10 seconds.
Wow.
So probably because I've been working and just happy to release. Mm, and mm, mm. So yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not one who can say, oh, read this book or that book. Probably not the best person to give you any guidance.
No, that's okay.
But there's lots of good books out there because yeah. everybody tells me about them.
That's good. Now, David, I've covered all my questions. I really appreciate you coming on to this interview. It's very, very kind of you to help sort this out today. Is there anything else that you wanted to just encapsulate? You've given some really good nuggets there regarding investing and how and what not to do and also what to do.
Going back through life, I think I've done things in periods. I see, in fact, when I made my notes, it was interesting to see before key dates in my life, you know, before being 20, before being 30,
yeah,
40,
39, 50, yeah.
you know, every time it seems I've made a decision to do something different.
Right.
And I think most people go through phases in life where they think, oh, you know what, I've done that. I don't feel I can go that's much further else. With it. Mm-hmm. I think we've all got to take the challenge. You know, if you don't do it, you probably won't be very happy because you'll think I should have done that. But don't go crazy.
Yeah.
Just enjoy life. Don't make decisions that will affect anyone else too much. Just make sure you do things steadily.
Okie dokie.
Yeah.
Okay, David Streder, thank you ever so much for coming on Conquest Corner. It's been an absolute
pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting
me. Take care.